Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So yesterday at 10:01 a.m., the Supreme Court released a landmark opinion on a fundamental constitutional issue. Then 6 minutes later, it released the health care decision. In an ordinary year at the Supreme Court, the Stolen Valor case, the one released at 10:01, about whether you're allowed to lie about receiving military decoration or a medal, would have been a bigger deal. So we thought we would take a few minutes now and talk about both, including the other big opinion that came down yesterday from the High Court. So our guest for this segment is coming off her biggest day at work. And if you were one of the over 500,000 people who were watching SCOTUS blog yesterday and waiting breathlessly for the healthcare decision, you know her well. She's Amy Howe, the editor of SCOTUS blog and a partner at Goldstein & Russell, a law firm specializing in Supreme Court litigation. Amy Howe, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. It's great to be back.
So do you get to jet off to Malta, too, now that the session is over, like I hear Justice Roberts is doing?
I am in my office in Washington, D.C., and we're facing one of the hottest days of the summer. So no Malta for me.
Back to your day job. Well, let's dive into the Stolen Valor case, and then we'll get to some health care. This has to do with whether it's constitutional to have a law that criminalizes lying about having received military decoration or a medal for your service. The court said that lying about your military record is protected speech, a First Amendment decision. So who's Alvarez in this case, which is known as Alvarez versus the United States?
This is a terrific case with really fun facts. Alvarez is Javier Alvarez, who went before the board of directors of the Three Valley Water District in California. He was one of the directors. He had already been elected. So the election had already happened. He was already on the board. And inexplicably, he tells the crowd there that he had been awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor and had served as an active duty Marine and been wounded, when in reality he had done none of those things. He'd never been in the military. Unfortunately, he was then prosecuted. He was first, subjected to what his lawyers call a public shaming as people got wind of this. But then he was also prosecuted for violating something called the Stolen Valor Act, which makes it a crime, as you say, to lie about having received military honors. He was sentenced to 3 years probation, 416 hours of community service, and had to pay a fine. And so he challenged his conviction on the ground that it was unconstitutional, that it violated his right to freedom of speech. And yesterday, in what, as you say, otherwise would have been a big, high-profile decision, the Supreme Court agreed with him.
So, listeners, Amy Howe is here. If you want to ask the editor of SCOTUS blog anything about the Stolen Valor decision, about the health care decision, about SCOTUS blog itself, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Now, my understanding of the decision is that it's unconstitutional to criminalize a lie just because it's a lie and it's offensive or something like that. There has to be some tangible harm that comes from a lie. Otherwise, you can't criminalize a lie for lying's sake or for the sake of truth. But veterans groups were arguing that there was actual harm in lying about military honors that he never received. What was that argument?
That argument was in veterans groups, and it's the argument that the government made as well. They say, look, these people who actually won military honors, who fought and were wounded, the value of their military honors is supposed to be special. But if you have people who can go out there willy-nilly and lie, like Javier Alvarez, and say he received the Congressional Medal of Honor when he never even served in the armed forces, takes away from the value of the honors for people who do actually earn them. And the Supreme Court, at least a plurality of the Supreme Court, was not buying that argument. They said, look, the government, haven't shown that this is actually a real problem. And my understanding is that these kinds of cases are prosecuted very rarely. The other thing that the plurality said, and this was a group of four justices, it wasn't a majority of the court, but four justices, made up of Justice Anthony Kennedy, the Chief Justice, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Justice Sonia Sotomayor. They said, look, if people are, you know, we can have a public shaming. If people are lying and we think that's a problem, you know, you can bring the truth to light. You can go out in public and say, look, Javier Alvarez, you never earned a medal in your life. You never served a day in your life. And so they were really unmoved by the government's rationale. There were two other justices, Justice Stephen Breyer and Justice Elena Kagan, who agreed with the result that the other four justices would have reached, that the Stolen Valor Act is unconstitutional. They wouldn't have applied as tough a test. They said, you know, look, here the law does too much, and this, it would apply, you know, you could be prosecuted and potentially even sent to jail if you were sitting around with your buddies, you know, and just like, sort of spouting off and telling tall tales, lying about having received military honors, sitting in a room with your friends, and that really goes too far. But one thing that's important is that it does look like we could well have a bill in the future. I think a bill has been introduced, in fact, that would make it a crime to lie about having received military honors if you do it to gain some benefit. And so Javier Alvarez here, you know, had already been elected. There's no, you know, he probably wouldn't have received, didn't receive any benefit from actually lying about it. But if you lied about it to get elected, if you lied about it, you know, to get money, then you could be prosecuted. And it does seem, after the court's opinion yesterday, that that kind of law could survive a constitutional challenge.
Interesting. So they may go back and try to enact something like that in Congress, but still the basic principle here is unless you establish some kind of harm or some kind of benefit, you can't just criminalize lying for the sake of the truth, except in cases of perjury where somebody is testifying under oath. Otherwise, their lies are protected by the First Amendment. Maybe all the politicians would be in jail if we were able to just criminalize lying. Let me take a couple of calls on this. Peter in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Peter, hello.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I would just say that being a veteran, it really doesn't sit right with me. I understand the arguments, and I'm not going to question what the Supreme Court does, but it really is very insulting and it leaves a terrible taste in my mouth. And also, I would just like respectfully to point out to your guest that that medal is referred to as the as the Medal of Honor, not the Congressional Medal of Honor. That's really all I really have to say at the moment.
Peter, thank you very much. Let's go to Chester in Harlem. Hi, Chester. You're on the air.
Hi. I know cases like these that go to the Supreme Court usually aren't funded by the individuals themselves. So, Mr. Alvarez, I'm assuming, didn't, you know, fund his case. I'm wondering if there are other interests or lobby groups or businesses that actually funded and advocated for his case to go this far.
Thank you for your question. Do you know, Amy Howe?
You know, I'm trying to figure that out right now, actually. I'm not sure off the top of my head. Certainly when the case went to the Supreme Court, it was brought there by the United States because the federal government had lost in the lower court, and so Mr. Alvarez certainly wouldn't have wanted that issue to reach the Supreme Court. It does look like he was, you know, represented, you know, at the Supreme Court and in all likelihood in the lower courts, you know, by public defenders. So, you know, there may well have been, you know, other groups behind him. I don't know whether, but I, you know, that's
and
certainly
I think
a possibility in any case. But I don't know whether it was the case here.
Right, and I think I would guess that politically progressive organizations that want a broad interpretation of the First Amendment with respect to this might have, whether they provided legal representation per se or not, they might have been in support of this, or people who don't want the military and military service to be elevated above other things and don't want the military, you know, specially glorified or sanctified in that kind of way, might have been on his side and potentially thrown money at it. Those would just be some of my guesses. But does it only apply to lying about getting a commendation if military service is not elevated above any other kind of job, which is basically what this decision says? Only lying about getting a commendation, or does it apply to lying in general about your service? You know, here in the tri-state area, I'm thinking of the case of Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal, where he got caught during his campaign for the Senate in several instances of a lie that he served in Vietnam when really he just served during the Vietnam era, but not in country. Listen.
We have learned something very important since the days that I served in Vietnam, and you exemplify it. Whatever we think about the war, whatever we call it, Afghanistan or Iraq, we owe our military men and women unconditional support. And we owe it to them not only while they're away, but when they come home.
So that became hugely controversial, as I'm sure you know. He got elected anyway. But was that or would that have been considered illegal under the Stolen Valor Act?
I don't, I'm not sufficiently familiar with the whole act. You know, the provision that was at issue here only applies to false claims about receipt of military decorations or medals. So certainly not this particular provision that was at issue in the Alvarez case. I don't know for sure, but certainly I think that the court would probably, you know, if asked, they may well suggest that something like this, you know, just as they discussed this possibility of sort of counter speech, if somebody lies about having received a Medal of Honor, then other people can speak out and come push back and say this person did not actually receive a Medal of Honor, and you know, maybe that the political process should take care of exaggerations and lies.
Right. And I guess if the court suggested that a law could be drawn to criminalize lying about military service if you're going to get some benefit from it, well, maybe a benefit would be to advance your cause as a politician seeking election. But they can't. They won't do it retroactively, even if they pass such a law. So I guess Richard Blumenthal is safe from that. My guest on WNYC is Amy Howe. She's the editor of SCOTUS Blog, the really, really good website that follows the doings of the Supreme Court. And they had about 500,000 hits yesterday morning. And I want to go to the healthcare decision right now. Here's one thing that I was curious about all day yesterday. It may be a technicality, but do you remember the first part of the oral arguments on the health reform law were about whether the Supreme Court could even rule yet on the law at all? And I thought the gist of that was, if it was a tax, they could not rule because they can't review a tax law until somebody is paying the tax, which no one is yet in this case. Did you follow that detail?
I did, exactly. And I got several questions about this from our readers yesterday, this idea that it's not a tax for purpose of whether or not the court can hear the case at all. But then, oh my goodness, the mandate is constitutional because the penalty that you have to pay is a tax. And so it's, you know, the court dealt with, after the argument about whether or not the court was able to hear the constitutionality of the mandate at all, you know, I think everyone thought that the court was in fact going to move on and decide the merits of whether or not the mandate is constitutional. But I don't think many people thought it would play out the way that it did, where the court would say the Anti-Injunction Act, which is the law that would keep the Supreme Court from reviewing the mandate at this time, doesn't apply because it's not a tax, but then the court would proceed to hold that, you know, the individual mandate is constitutional because it's basically a tax. And the court's answer, you know, the court addressed this. It only spent about four pages of the opinion addressing it, but it did address it. And it said, look, Congress is totally aware of the Anti-Injunction Act and this idea that we wouldn't be able to review the mandate if it were a tax. And it called the payment that you have to pay if you don't buy health insurance a penalty rather than a tax. And so we're not going to look beyond that for the most part. If Congress says it's not a tax for purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act, we're going to go ahead and believe it. But then for purposes of whether or not the mandate is constitutional, the court says it's a different test. You don't apply the same test that we used for the Anti-Injunction Act. And really, it is a tax.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to get your take on the new legacy of Chief Justice John Roberts after the shocking decision yesterday. We're going to play 20 seconds of how Chris Matthews started talking differently about John Roberts, 20 seconds of how Rush Limbaugh started talking differently about John Roberts, and we'll get your take and also your take on why you got it right on your blog, which we were following very closely as our show began yesterday, while CNN and Fox News and some others got it wrong. Stay with us as we continue with Amy Howe, editor of SCOTUS Blog. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Amy Howe, editor of SCOTUS Blog. And here's what Chris Matthews had to say about Chief Justice Roberts after yesterday's decision.
Today's hero, Chief Justice John Roberts, who walked to the forefront of history and said yes to progress and no to the role prescribed for him by the right. He would not let the court named for him carry historic blame for denying health care to tens of millions of Americans. He would not be the ramrod for yet another right-leaning, partisan-appearing Supreme Court ruling.
Chris Matthews on MSNBC. How about you, Rush Limbaugh?
If people found out, if they can prove that Roberts changed his vote because of intimidation, it won't change anything about this outcome. And I don't think anybody is ever going to be able to firmly establish that this happens. I don't want to be misunderstood here, but this decision is so shocking to people.
Somebody got to him? Okay, maybe. So, Amy Howe, as closely as you have followed the career of John Roberts since joining the Supreme Court, how shocked were you yesterday that he joined the liberals in the court to uphold so-called Obamacare?
You know, after the oral argument, I think going into the oral argument, certainly I think a lot of people thought that there was a chance that he would uphold the mandate and allow the Affordable Care Act to go into effect. You know, he has consistently supported, you know, a fairly broad role for the federal government. After the oral argument, I think people were a little more skeptical that he would vote to uphold the mandate because the discussion of the constitutionality of the mandate focused so heavily on the Commerce Clause, whether or not Congress could require people to buy health insurance using its power to regulate interstate commerce. And the Chief Justice was among the, you know, multiple justices who seemed very skeptical of that argument. And so, you know, in the end, it came down to him joining, you know, the four other conservative justices to agree that Congress can't do this using its power under the Commerce Clause, but that it can do this using its power under the taxing clause, which was something that the court's four more liberal justices agreed with him on. So it was, you know, a little bit of a surprise that it happened the way that it did, certainly.
We can't get into his head, but a lot of people are analyzing this as a paradox. He may have tried to rescue the court from a permanent descent into politics with a political decision. It may make the court look more idiosyncratic and unpredictable, maybe, than respectively constitutional.
You know, I personally don't think there was a lot of sort of strategic thinking. I think he really did sort of call this one the way he saw it, with the result being that the mandate and therefore the rest of the act survived. I mean, a lot of, you know, not so much that the politicians, but the legal scholars who had oppose the law are actually, you know, obviously not crazy about the results, but, you know, pretty comfortable with the opinion itself, because although the president and the Affordable Care Act won out in the end, they have the sense that even if the president won the battle, the Chief Justice's opinion actually won the war going forward for people who support more limited government. You know, the five justices rejected the government's Commerce Clause argument, and so it's going to make it harder for Congress to use its power under that clause to, you know, act in the future. And then the other provision that people haven't paid as much attention on, which required states to choose between complying with the new eligibility requirements for Medicaid, the federal-state partnership that provides health insurance to the poor. Under the Affordable Care Act, as it was drafted, you had to either comply with these new eligibility requirements or risk losing all of your funds for Medicaid from the federal government, which is a huge amount of money. And, you know,
they struck down that penalty, which we talked about in depth on the last hour of the show.
Yeah, exactly. So, Yeah, I think it depends sort of on your perspective. I think from a political perspective, opponents of the law are very unhappy with the Chief Justice, but the opponents of the law from a legal perspective are significantly less unhappy and in some cases, you know, quite comfortable with the decision.
I wonder about what George W. Bush is thinking now about his handpicked Chief Justice.
Indeed.
But on that Commerce Clause point, Stephen on our comments page just wrote, and this is reflective of quite a few people who've written it in the last day, quote, Roberts' decision is a Trojan horse to kill the federal government's ability to regulate interstate commerce, which much civil rights legislation is built on. Watch out, unquote. So that's a conspiracy theory from the other side.
Right. I mean, and I think that I don't know that I would go so far as to call it a conspiracy theory, certainly, but, you know, we're still sort of everyone is focused right now on the decision, the, you know, what this means for the court, what this means for the Affordable Care Act. But I do think people who are much more knowledgeable about, you know, constitutional law and Commerce Clause legislation in particular than I am are going to start unpacking the court's decision. And it will be very interesting. It, you know, I think the predictions that it could have some fairly wide sweeping effects could well prove to be true.
We have a few minutes left with Amy Howe, editor of SCOTUS blog. So at 10.06 a.m. yesterday, you had 520,000 readers. At 10.07, you wrote, we have healthcare opinion. I was one of those readers, by the way. We all had, on the air, we all had to wait a whole other minute to see you write, the individual mandate survives as a tax. What were those few minutes like for you, and how was yesterday unlike any other day of watching the Supreme Court?
To have the court, you know, so much in the forefront of everyone's attention was really surreal. You know, I don't think that, you know, we were watching how many people were on the live blog and then monitoring our hits later, but, you know, we were so focused on covering the court that I don't think it has fully sunk in yet that it was so extraordinary a day for us. We were really focused primarily on getting the decision right and having the website not crash. And in particular with regard to having it not crash, right around the time that we got the decision, we, you know, sort of realized, okay, I think the website's going to make it. And there was this huge sense of relief that we were able to go ahead and focus on the decision. The decision was, you know, I think it was not a decision that the Chief Justice drafted for the benefit of the news media. And so, you know, this was, I think, a common source of the mistake. You know, if you look first at the government's argument about why the mandate was constitutional had focused so heavily on the Commerce Clause, and then you go ahead and you look at the opinion, and, you know, there are five votes rejecting the government's argument. And so then you really had to sort of hunker down and figure out exactly what was going on.
That's how CNN and the Fox News Channel got it wrong for the first few minutes yesterday. If it was a reporter writing that story, the reporter would have written, we uphold the individual mandate in the president's health care law. Here's why.
Right.
And started
exactly
with that. But he started with a couple of pages of the individual mandate is not supported by the Commerce Clause. That came first before he went on to it is supported by the taxing provisions. And so the people from those two cable networks jumped at that first piece of information and put on the air, the individual mandate is struck down because it's not supported by the Commerce Clause.
Exactly. And, you know, it's an easy mistake to make because what people are usually looking at when they really want to sort of get information about the decision quickly is what's called the syllabus, which is a short summary of the opinion at the front of the opinion itself. And that the structure of that syllabus really mirrored the structure of the opinion. So you had to even sort of skim through the syllabus for a while to get to the part where you realized that, oh, the mandate does survive.
Well, luckily for us, we were following AP, which did wait and get it right, and we were following you. So that mistake was not passed down to our listeners, luckily. Before you go, big picture about this year on the court. Isn't it interesting that Scalia, Alito, and Thomas were in dissent in every case this week? In fact, it's been on the whole, a very good term for liberals, even though we talk about this conservative, Citizens United Supreme Court. The Nation had a long list of articles on their website yesterday. The court struck down mandatory life sentences for juveniles, invalidated penalties on broadcasters for indecent speech, invalidated most of Arizona's immigration law, ruled that installing a GPS to monitor a car's movement requires a warrant, applied a liberalized crack cocaine sentencing regime, not to mention health care and the Stolen Valor Act, which is, you know, considered what liberals would have wanted. What happened to this supposedly conservative court?
You know, I saw a headline yesterday. I didn't have a chance to read the story that said that Mitt Romney had raised $2 million off of yesterday's ruling in health care. Absolutely. That this, you know, the Supreme Court, there's a conventional wisdom about the Supreme Court, but, you know, just as often the Supreme Court seems to turn around and defy the conventional wisdom. And so, you know, around the 2010 elections, the president and the Democrats were sort of running against the Supreme Court and Citizens United. And, you know, we need a conservative, we need a new Supreme Court. And now it's going to be, you know, in no small part, I imagine, the Republicans running against the Supreme Court and the president holding up the decision in the healthcare case. As you know, see, I've got this signature legislative accomplishment that was upheld by the Supreme Court, including by one very conservative Chief Justice. So there's something for everyone
in
yesterday's ruling.
And I'll just mention that a lot of those 500,000 people on your blog yesterday in the 10 o'clock hour were journalists, constitutional lawyers, and people at the White House, as it turns out. But that can't account for all of those readers. So we will just, note that SCOTUS blog is not just an inside thing. And people who want to follow the Supreme Court, we recommend you to it. And I'm sure it was exciting for you to have more people on your site this week than you've had any other time in your six-year history. So, Amy Howe, thank you for the good work, editor of SCOTUS blog, and thank you for coming on and talking to us today.
Well, thank you for the kind words, and thank you for inviting me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.